to avoid spilling over into the cocktail hour, I guess, we need to get this last session going. And, you know, the proverbial statement, we save the best for last here. Isn't it supposed to be the Asian century?
It is.
I heard something about the Asian century. So, and migration, as we know, has been an issue in Asia, especially East Asia, for quite some time. And, you know, I wrote a paper about Japanese immigration policy with Michael Sharp, who unfortunately can't be with us here today. He's had stayed with a son who's graduating from middle school. But that paper provoked a lot of negative and positive reaction, depending on which side of this issue you're on. I think Aaron even had, or somebody had, a graduate student who wrote a rejoinder to the piece, which I don't know if it got published. But so my point is that, you know, Korea and Japan are you know, absolutely critical cases in the Asian context. They're members of the OECD, so they're in this club. And in like the previous paper where I recruited Gerasimos and Fiona to team up to write about Greece and Turkey, in this case, I really hit the jackpot because I have one person who could write a single chapter about Korea and Japan, which she's been doing for a long time. So, Aaron, do you want to, are you going to go to the podium? Thank you.
So first, I'd like to thank Jim and Francois for an invigorating and insightful conference. I apologize for being a latecomer to the conference, but I'm happy that...
We're glad you're here.
I'm happy that I can make it. And I said this in our Dallas conference, but I just want to reiterate that East Asian industrial democracies are infrequently included in comparative studies of immigration and citizenship. And you know, the controlling immigration editors have included Japan and then Korea since the first edition in 1994, which says a lot about the editors. So first, I just want to start off by saying that Japan and Korea are among just a handful of industrial democracies where immigration does not occupy center stage in politics today. Despite labor shortages since the 1980s and an impending demographic crisis, with forecasts that the working age population will decrease to just slightly over 50% of the total population as soon as 2050 in both countries, immigration levels are much lower than they should be given each country's levels of development. As some of you may know, in a 2001 report on replacement migration, the United Nations Population Division estimated that Japan would have to admit about 647,000 immigrants and Korea about 129,000 immigrants annually to meet, to alleviate the labor shortages as well as meet the fiscal burdens of an increasingly and rapidly growing elderly population. Now, the number of foreign nationals in both countries has grown at a rapid pace in recent years, over threefold in Japan from about 850,000 in 1985 to almost 2.6 million in 2017, and more than tenfold in Korea from about 210,000 in 2000 to almost 2.2 million in 2017. Nevertheless, foreign residents still make up only about 2% of the total population in Japan and about 4% in Korea, which is especially stark given the record pace by which both total populations are decreasing every year. And it certainly is well below the recommended 30% that was outlined in the UN report. So they're thus often described as the negative cases of immigration, in which there are no trade-offs, neither rights nor numbers, right? So to explain why East Asian countries have resisted large-scale immigration, the dominant scholarship has tended to focus on cultural determinants based on claims of ethnocultural homogeneity and characterizing them as laggards or latecomers to immigration. Now, there are signs that this may be changing. In 2004, Korea introduced an official guest worker program called the Employment Permit System that treats foreign workers equally as Korean workers and protects them under all labor laws. And Japan's parliament passed an unprecedented bill last November, which would open the country's borders to up to 345,000 semi-skilled workers in agriculture, nursing, construction, shipbuilding, and hospitality over a five-year period. Now, this is especially significant because both of these changes would mark the first time, or do mark the first time, that both countries would open their borders officially to unskilled immigration in post-war history. Now, in explaining what many have characterized as the convergence toward increasingly liberal immigration policies and expanding alien rights, comparative studies of international migration and citizenship have tended to focus on two types of variables that we've discussed throughout the conference. In other words, international norms and domestic political elites. But if international norms have pushed democracies in Europe and North America toward liberalization, they've had an uneven, indeterminate impact on prompting reforms in East Asia, and they certainly have not prompted immigration reform in either Japan or Korea. And most reforms to Japan and Korea's immigration policies have been implemented only after considerable pressure had already been applied from internal grassroots movements. In most cases, courts, legislatures, political parties have only grudgingly responded to the demands for liberalization. And this is largely due to the fact that because Japan and Korea maintained official closed-door policies to immigration, largely unskilled immigration, throughout the 1980s and 1990s, immigrants within their borders were, for the most part, populations to be expelled or deported, and certainly not incorporated. Immigration policy reform and patterns of immigrant incorporation, therefore, were not the products of deliberate decision-making on the part of policymakers. Rather, they reflect the unintended consequences of Japan and Korea's side-door immigration policies that have enabled both states to maintain low levels of immigration while securing necessary foreign labor since the 1990s, namely the industrial trainee system that brought in so-called trainees, largely from other Asian countries, who were not officially recognized as workers and thus not protected by labor laws, making them especially vulnerable to industrial accidents, employer abuse, as well as unpaid wages. And the second side door, of course, were co-ethnic immigration policies for Nikkei or ethnic Japanese, largely from Brazil and Peru to Japan, and then ethnic Koreans from China, known as Chosonjok, to Korea. And this created a relatively ample pool of unskilled workers with extended visas that would presumably pose a minimal threat to social stability as well as ethnic homogeneity. Now, in Korea's case, the exploitative practices that were generated by the industrial trainee system in particular mobilized a wide range of civil society actors to advocate for migrant worker rights. So rather than an anti-immigrant mobilization, there was a pro-immigrant mobilization. And this has to do with Korea's democratization timing. So less than 5 years after nationwide anti-government protests had toppled Chun-doo-hwan's authoritarian regime, more than 45,000 foreign migrant workers had entered Korea in 1991 to fill labor shortages. And among them, over 90% were undocumented. Now, as the government had been enacting plans to deport all of the undocumented migrant workers and then import additional migrant workers who would soon become undocumented, a network of Korean NGOs who had worked at the forefront of Korea's democratization movement until the 1980s quickly reestablished themselves as pro-immigrant advocates, using the same symbols and tools of the labor movement. So slogans such as, "We are human, not animals," or "We are not slaves," came to epitomize the migrant worker movement in South Korea, just as the slogan, "We are not machines," had been the main slogan used during Korea's democratization movement and labor rights movement. And you can see that even the repertoires of protests are very similar. So these are slides comparing the anti-government protests during the 1980s and a migrant worker protest in 2003, which was led by the Korean Federation of Trade Unions, which was one of the most important organizations during the labor rights movement. And these slides show that the repertoire, the responses to the riot police are very similar. If you look at other photographs, you'll see that even the clothing is very similar, the colors, the hats, the scarves, and even the ways in which they deal with the police are very similar. This is a type of training, a political learning process. And even the site of protest has been overlapping. This compares the June 1987 protests with the migrant workers' November 2003 protests in front of the Myeongdong Cathedral in Seoul, which has historically been the stage and refuge for anti-government protesters in the era of military rule. Now, what is most significant about these pro-immigrant NGOs is their position within Korea's democratization movement and post-1987 democratic consolidation. That is, these groups represent a cross-section of groups that were at the forefront of Korea's democratization movement. So these include radical and moderate labor unions, women's organizations, religious institutions, as well as a kind of a wide array of progressive citizen groups. So their strong tradition of activism, coupled with the reconfiguration of political power from the late 1990s with the inauguration of Korea's first opposition president, Kim Dae-jung, in 1998, and a former human rights activist and labor lawyer, Noh Moon-hyun, in 2003, lent the struggle for migrant labor rights significant potency and magnitude in Korean society. Because after all, how could a pro-labor government condone exploitative practices against migrant workers that many in the administration, including the president himself, had struggled against for decades? So this means that neither international pressure nor domestic elites catalyzed immigration reform in Korea. Instead, the migrant worker movement successfully pushed for reforms by reframing the debate from the dangers that migrant workers posed on Korean society to the dangers that an exploitative industrial trainee system posed to the hard-won rights of Korean workers. Now, Japan's industrial trainee system generated many of the same problems that arose in Korea, so the exploitative practices by employers, as well as a rapidly growing population of undocumented workers among the trainees. In fact, the creation of the restrictive trainee visa for within Japan was based on the assumption that ethnically distinct workers from other Asian countries would seek to settle permanently in Japan, much like Turkish and Yugoslav workers had done in Germany. And thus, in order to prevent this from happening, they needed to be closely monitored with short-term visas and employment restrictions. On the other hand, the proponents of the Nikkeijin, or long-term resident visa for Nikkeijin, believed that Nikkeijin workers who were at least Japanese by blood would quickly adapt to life in Japan, right? But by the late 1990s, as you might expect, it became clear that most ethnic Japanese migrants were not quickly adapting to life in Japan just because they were co-ethnics, right? They tended to demonstrate low rates of Japanese language fluency, even sometimes lower than their Chinese and Korean counterparts, and faced many of the same problems as other foreigners in Japan. But the big crisis came when many ethnic Japanese workers lost their jobs during the first major economic recession of the early 2000s. And they ended up not only staying in Japan, but also relying on unemployment assistance, right? And this became more, for Ministry of Justice officials, this was seen as a burden to Japanese society, and you've heard that before. So the government offered to pay for one-way tickets for those who promised to return to Latin America and never come back. Well, at least not come back for 3 years under the long-term visa. So since 2009, as a result, the population of Brazilian and Peruvians in Japan has declined by more than 30%. Meanwhile, despite perennial complaints regarding labor abuses, the trainee program had been effective in directing workers specifically towards small and medium-sized businesses, especially those that were struggling in depopulated rural areas. So rather than abolish what conservative and liberal policymakers alike deemed a failed system, Japan established the Technical Intern Training Program, or TITP, in 1993, which extended residency periods and also offered protections against exploitative practices. And since 2015, the Ministry of Justice has dramatically increased quotas for some categories of trainees, especially construction workers, in preparation for the 2020 Olympic Games in Tokyo. So the current proposal to establish an official guest worker program has actually not been accompanied by legislative moves to abolish the industrial trainee system. On the contrary, it represents the culmination of incremental adjustments to what can be characterized as an illiberal status quo. And in fact, the Abe administration has made clear that, that migrant workers are not immigrants, and that the proposed revision is not equivalent to a full-fledged immigration policy, much like Germany did several decades ago. At the same time, what's distinguishing Japan from other European developers who experienced this kind of same crisis is that the policies and programs for legally registered foreign residents who are already settled within Japan are already among the most generous of industrial democracies. Now, these contrasting approaches to managing immigration into Japan, right, and incorporating non-national residents who are already settled in Japan, reflect the cycles of Japan's immigration history. By the time that the most recent wave of immigration began to arrive in the late 1980s, they were met not by an insular society that was not prepared for immigration, as the story often goes, but rather by numerous civil society organizations and local governments that had already been addressing issues and initiatives directly related to foreign residents. So Japan was remarkably well prepared for large-scale immigration. Whereas foreign residents routinely faced discrimination in employment, in housing, education, healthcare, and legal status protections until the late 1970s, their legal status and rights were on par with those of other immigrants in other advanced industrial democracies by the early 1980s, so again, before the arrival of large-scale immigration, as a result of social movements led by multi-generational Korean residents and their descendants known as Zainichi Koreans, the vast majority of whom are former colonial subjects and their descendants. So in Japan's case then, immigrant incorporation patterns began prior to the arrival of the most recent wave of immigration from the late 1980s, largely at the local level with decentralized grassroots movements taking the lead. And in both countries, the processes of immigrant incorporation in the forms of advocacy, support, and political mobilization, as well as the establishment of services, institutions, and local programs for foreign residents, preceded official acknowledgement of immigrants within their midst. Right? So we can talk about a very specific type of gap in the case of Japan. It's a type of unintended consequence, right? But that it really focuses on the sequence of immigration policy reform and immigrant incorporation. That is, immigrant incorporation preceded immigration policy reform, and that's one of the reasons why we see much lower rates of anti-immigrant violence and sentiment, because there isn't a liberalized, open immigration policy to react against, right? Japan has actually been more remarkable for its ability to stabilize these restrictive immigration policies for decades. So, are Japan and Korea becoming countries of immigration? My answer is no.
La question à mille francs.
Because they already are countries of immigration. As a former imperial power to which the largest flows of immigration occurred before 1945, Japan has been grappling with the challenge of immigrant incorporation well before its European counterparts encountered large-scale immigration. Post-colonial South Korea, which remains one of the major immigrant-sending countries to Japan, adopted Japan's closed-door policies as well as its side-door immigration policies before it officially opened its borders. But neither the state nor the public have acknowledged the existence of immigrants in Japan and Korea. Instead, They've been called colonial subjects, foreigners, and now migrant workers. So rather than laggards that are decades behind on a single trajectory toward becoming liberal countries of immigration, East Asian democracies have been on a different trajectory altogether that increasingly resembles the Singaporean and Gulf state models rather than what we might expect to find in industrial democracies. But as so-called traditional countries of immigration, such as the United States, enact increasingly restrictive measures to curb both legal as well as unauthorized immigration, we may soon find that Japan and Korea's models of immigration control are the norm. Thank you.
Thank you.